They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Mission to Mars, how much did it cost?
And how soon do we drill, baby, drill? Hey, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, August 6th. Coming up, the drought that's plaguing the Midwest. We're going to talk about another effect of it, which is its effect on ranchers who are really not doing well right now.
And we'll talk about a new study on the revolving door. And in this case, they look at the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, this phenomenon of people going from private to public and then back into the private sector again. Is it really as bad as we think? And Jeremy and I are going to talk about why running becomes such a dominant Olympic sport for places like Jamaica and Kenya. It's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, Jeff, we have touched down on Mars.
Woohoo!
The NASA rover Curiosity landed on the surface of the red planet late last night. We'll take a look at the economic costs and benefits of putting another rover on Mars. But first, here is Marketplace's Eve Troe with a look at the time and money it took to make this possible.
The costs of interplanetary exploration are, indeed, astronomical. The previous Mars rovers, named Spirit and Opportunity, cost about $1 billion. The little tank-like vehicle that landed today cost $2.5 billion. But Pamela Conrad, a key scientist on the mission at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says no one there is thinking, did it cost too much? They're only thinking,
we're on Mars!
And what about the public reaction?
Well, given the number of hits on our various NASA websites tonight, I would say that sentiment is well shared.
Conrad says a high-profile mission like this one spurs interest and spending on science education and encourages public investment in technology that can seem like a long shot at first.
I think that any great country has to have a diversified portfolio of investments, both in terms of its intellectual pursuits and its financial investments.
No speculation on future funding, though Mars research is slated for cuts next year. For now, Conrad says she's glued on images of Mars. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, scientists say they're primarily searching for signs of life with this visit by Curiosity.
Yep.
But this is Marketplace, right? So, of course, we naturally see dollar signs down here. And we're not the only ones. Companies are springing up with the goal of extracting non-earthly resources from asteroids, from the moon, from Mars. Chris Carberry is director of Explore Mars. It's a nonprofit that promotes Mars missions and education about the red planet. Great to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Going to Mars with rovers, later with people, I mean, this is all feel-good, you know, Star Trek-y kind of stuff. Is there an economic reason to be there?
Actually, there are many economic reasons to be there. For instance, it could really be a great boost for national morale. And when you get the nation excited, that can have a direct impact on the economy and where the market goes in general. Yeah, but this goes well beyond that as well. During the Apollo landings, millions of students were inspired to go into science and technology fields because they were inspired by those moon landings. If we had spent the money on education, I don't know if we would have had the same impact as that inspirational value of landing on the moon.
But let's get a little bit cynical, but maybe also more realistic here. As I understand it, there's good evidence Mars has lots of magnesium, chromium, other metals even more rare. They might just be sitting right on the surface. How far off is Mars mining?
Mars mining is a long ways off. probably the thing that's probably the most value on Mars to initially would be the water, which they've found. But I think maybe, you know, 50 or 100 years off, depending how well we build up our infrastructure, and that's the whole key, eventually we may be able to mine minerals there. But that is still a long ways off.
If we were to look far out into the future, however long it takes for us to begin, let's say, mining Mars, are you worried about the implications that we would pillage that place?
I would hope as we go forward, we would take the lessons we've learned here and put them to use more effectively on Mars. But there is always the prospect that we might actually ruin the planet. We may not be controlling that process. It might be other nations. But if I had to guess on this, I would say that we're going to do it in a responsible manner.
Chris Carberry with Explore Mars, congratulations on the landing, and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, Jeremy, for those of us who saw Avatar, we know it always works out fine in the end, right? That kind of thing. Quick check of the markets here. It was a really good day for markets in Asia. The Nikkei index up 2%. Markets up in China, 1.7% in Hong Kong. European markets clicking over, also having a pretty strong day. And in the U.S. as well. Looks like maybe people still feeling that little bump from the jobs report on Friday.
That's right. And a couple of other stories down on Wall Street. Knight Capital, the financial firm that caused all those wild stock swings last week because of a software glitch, says it has found $400 million to keep it from going under for now. Also, Best Buy shares are up by double digits this morning after the company's founder said he wants to take Best Buy private by buying up all of its shares.
NBC has been criticized, we've talked about this, for not running Olympic events live. They're running them instead, for the most part, in primetime, at least the good stuff. Did that yesterday with the much-anticipated men's 100-meter sprint final. Usain Bolt won it. Spoiler alert for people who still haven't seen
it.
It's
too late now.
Oh, well. Criticism aside, NBC is looking at strong ratings for the games so far. And as Queen Akim reports, the Olympics could help the network long after the torch leaves London.
Olympics aside, NBC's primetime ratings have been in the pits for nearly a decade. But with 30 million people tuning into the Olympics every night, entertainment analyst Hal Vogel says NBC has a chance to turn things around.
Large events and television viewing are quite rare these days because television audience is very fragmented. This offers the network an opportunity.
NBC has been using the opportunity to promote fall shows like Go On with Matthew Perry.
I think if you were to tally who's the biggest sponsor of the Olympics, it'd be NBC promos.
Brad Adgate is an analyst at Horizon Media. Adgate says that the Olympics can only sway audiences so much.
They may sample the show, but if they don't like the show, they're not going to watch week two or week three.
Not to mention the other 22 shows in the season. I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
Well, easy come, easy go with these kinds of things. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Jeremy, has dropped off Bloomberg's top 10 list of the richest tech billionaires.
Poor guy.
Yeah, well, you know, that's going to happen because it's all based on paper, right? The shares of Facebook are near record lows now. From our wealth and poverty desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji has more.
Man, we are obsessed with billionaires, aren't we?
It's a way of keeping score. People love to keep score.
Carrie Dolan is a senior editor at Forbes. She covers billionaires for the magazine.
It's one of the most popular things that we do.
But can you keep score if one billionaire's money is tied up in his company's publicly traded shares and another has hard assets, cash in the bank, gold in a vault, that sort of thing?
One of the real risks is that, you know, you have billions wrapped up in a single company. If that company doesn't perform or succeed, you have a very undiversified portfolio.
Richard Florida is a business professor at the University of Toronto.
We've created this paper billionaire phenomenon, and they come and they go.
I don't know. I don't really like the term paper billionaire.
Carrie Dolan of Forbes says there is real value in the company shares that billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg own, and that should count toward their net worth. And Zuckerberg, he may not be on the 10 richest tech billionaires list anymore, but as of today, he's still the B word. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
If you were wondering, as of today, Mark Zuckerberg sits at number 24 on Forbes' overall list of global billionaires. He's one spot below Steve Jobs' widow, Laureen Powell Jobs, founders of Google and Amazon.com. They just missed the top 10. And within that top 10, Jeremy, four are Waltons.
Yes, the Walmart,
Walmart fortune. And the world's richest man by quite a bit, and I think this is since Warren Buffett and Bill Gates have begun giving away a fair amount of their money, but he's got quite a lead now. He's from Mexico, telecom magnate Carlos Slim.
Carlos Slim. Well, while we're sharing lists, Jeff, the scientific journal Lancet has released a list of the laziest countries in the world, measured by the amount of physical activity that the people in each country do.
Nice.
And the winner, or I guess we could probably say loser, is Malta.
Okay.
Malta, the Mediterranean island nation, its population is apparently 72% inactive.
Well, I haven't been there, but I can't judge.
But the real surprise for me, Jeff, was the least lazy country, according to Lancet, which is Greece.
Huh.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that the country at the center of the debt crisis, because I guess they want to retire at age 52 or whatever, is the least lazy. But in fact, only 15% of them lead sedentary lifestyles.
So, Jeremy, Jamaica, I saw, did not appear to make at least the top 20 on this list. And that's not surprising as we watch the Olympics, right? The Jamaicans are one serious running country.
They're very fast.
Right. Usain Bolt from Jamaica just won the 100 meters, his second Olympic gold in the event. Jamaica and other island nations have become known for their sprinting power, especially in the same way countries like Kenya maybe are known for their strength in distance running.
Well, here to talk to us in today's Midday Extra about how countries come to specialize in certain sports and events is Scott Douglas. He's the news editor of Runner's World. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Well, how do countries like Jamaica come to specialize in certain events like that? Is there a lot of investment in running there or what?
From a government standpoint, no. The broad answer for any country would be sort of the combination of genetics, culture, and tradition. Those three items sort of feeding on each other in a sort of positive feedback cycle. Then once you have some success, that just starts feeding on itself, and more, you know, young people want to become sprinters. Young people in Jamaica want to become the next Usain Bolt. They see he's a millionaire. They see he's one of the most best-known people in the world, and so that's what you start doing. Just like here in the States, young people might tend towards playing basketball.
Mm-hmm. What's the level of government involvement in Jamaica, for example, once they start seeing a trend like that?
As far as I know, nothing.
Really? Which is so different from, you think of a country like, I was watching diving yesterday, and China, right, which dominates diving because they've decided they're going to be great at diving and put a ton of money into it. That's really interesting about Jamaica.
Right. So you know, it used to be more the case that there were more countries like that, you know, back during the Soviet time. Now it's much more just private investment. There are some shoe companies. Usain Bolt is sponsored by Puma, and Puma is well represented in Jamaica financially.
Are there any odd ducks on the list of countries that you know, have really great running teams?
Well, Japan is interesting because Japanese women have been among the most successful in the Olympic marathon. But Japan, they have incredible marathoners, but that's it. Most countries, if you have a lot of great marathoners, you also have a lot of good 10K runners like Kenya or Ethiopia. Japan, they put all their resources into the marathon. It's like all they care about. And it gets back to the sort of culture and finances sort of backing each other up, because it's just, there's something about the marathon. It's so Japanese, just, you know, the whole aspect of just this incredible will aspect of it, that's where they put all their resources. If you're a good distance runner, you're encouraged to become a marathoner, whereas in a lot of other countries, you might be encouraged to try other distance running events.
So where were the Japanese in yesterday's women's marathon?
Of course. Now that I've said that, they didn't do as well as they have in the past.
It's early. It's early yet. So, Scott, here in the U.S., I'm thinking of, say, professional basketball, right?
Right.
You can be very successful. You can make a lot of money, and many kids, for better and for worse, some would say, invest a lot of their time and energy in that dream. Is that effect present in a place like Jamaica, where, you know, I mean, there are the people saying, I know you want to run, but it's a 1 in a million shot. Why don't you focus on school?
Yes. Any country where there's not, you know, there's not the greatest economic prospects for the average person, I think that you would then tend to, and you see that others have succeeded in that, then that's where you gravitate to. I mean, the great example is Kenya, where you can go. There's a town called E10 Kenya where I went once and spent a month there, and there's maybe 3,000 people living in the town. There's maybe 500 people who are legitimately good runners. They're setting everything else aside, trying to become one of the 10 people from that town who can get out of the country and go road race in the U.S. and win money. It just starts feeding on itself. Once you see that there's a lot of money by your standards to be made.
Well, Scott Douglas, news editor of Runner's World, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Congress has left Washington now for its August recess, and still no firm plans to avoid this so-called fiscal cliff, spending cuts and tax increases that are due to go in effect at the end of this year.
Those cuts were set in motion exactly 1 year ago during the debt ceiling fight that led to a downgrade of America's credit rating. And Mike Lofgren remembers it all very well. It convinced him to pack his bags after nearly 30 years working for Republicans on Capitol Hill. He's just written a book about it called The Party is Over, and he's with us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Good to be here.
What was it about that debt ceiling fight that was so much different than all the other big political fights that have happened during your tenure in the Capitol?
Well, I think we've heretofore past debt limit increases about 87 times since World War II without any problem. And yet Republicans in particular in the House were holding the nation's credit rating hostage to what they wanted to get.
Well, of course, the Republicans only had that debt ceiling fight, they said, because they were worried about the nation's huge debt and deficits.
Superficially, that's true. But from what I saw in the House and Senate budget committees, it's a kind of phony claim because they always subordinate deficit reduction to giving tax breaks to their wealthy contributors. So I think the deficit hawk claim is fraudulent. It's simply bait to get concerned Americans to vote for them.
Well, so how did we get here? How did we get to this point? Is it campaign finance? Is it just the culture of Washington? What happened?
I think it's a sort of congruence of corporate money taking over the system and kind of the rise of a polarized nation based on 24/7 talk radio and cable catfights on television. And both parties are controlled by their campaign donations. Both are sort of corporate controlled. The Democrats are a little more ashamed about it, but they still respond to those signals from corporate America. For instance, Obama's health care bill was kind of a cornucopia for the insurance companies since they maintain a lot of subsidies, and Big Pharma gets payday just as it previously did.
Well, so what do we do from here, Mike Lofgren? I mean, how do we fix the system so that it works for people, works for the middle class in this country?
I believe the first step is to get the money out of politics. Now, that's a very hard thing to do because we got a Supreme Court decision that basically says anything goes. But as long as the politicians, and I'm not saying by any means they're all corrupt, there are many honest people, but they're in a situation where they have to play the same game or they're gone because any opponent can simply outraise them and avalanche them with money.
Well, Mike Lofgren, author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Politicians and government watchdogs are perpetually worried about something they call the revolving door. I think we've mentioned it before on Marketplace plenty of times. Private sector people take jobs in government for a while, then they leave again for the private world. The worry is that their own economic incentives will affect their work as public servants. Well, a team of researchers this morning has a new paper out that looks at this effect on lawyers at the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. Simi Kadia is a professor of finance and economics at the Rutgers Business School. Good to talk with you.
Very good to be here.
So lawyers go to work at the SEC for a while, then go on to some presumably plum job in the private sector. What specifically is the concern about how their work might be affected?
So the specific concern might be, for example, that if they want to get a job in a private law firm and they are involved in a case where the private law firm is defending a client against the SEC, that they may somehow compromise the SEC regulatory effort and be sort of more lenient towards the private law firm who they might eventually want to join.
So that's the kind of gut feeling. Doesn't sound like there was much data on it, though. How did you actually test that?
We basically tested whether the SEC lawyers who eventually leave the SEC to join private law firms, did they somehow do less rigorous regulatory effort while they were at the SEC and possibly contemplating leaving the SEC to join the private law firms. And so we found actually quite contrary that not only there was no less regulatory effort, we found that they actually worked harder while they were at the SEC.
And they might actually have, dare we say, integrity.
Yes.
Does this lessen your own cynicism? Does it give you more faith in our public servants, at least at the SEC?
It does work, although I do like to point out that we are able to look at only a very small segment of the data. So it does lessen my skepticism. And given that the SEC has been under a lot of scrutiny in the past few years, it does seem to suggest that some things are working right.
Simi Kadia, Professor of Finance and Economics at Rutgers. Great to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, now to the weather. Jeff, there is a forecast for the Midwest, and it's got just a little bit of something they could really use, and that is, of course, rain.
That's good to hear.
That sent corn prices falling a bit last Friday as soon as that forecast came out. But as Harvest Public Media's Frank Morris reports, the rain could be too little too late for the nation's ranchers.
It's hot and dry out in western Kansas in a good year. South of Dodge City, the native grass is tough. So are the ranchers.
My name is Nathan Pike.
Pike is a spry, son of the Dust Bowl.
Well, I was born in a drought, and I've been through several. But this one is probably the most damaging one I've seen. I've never seen buffalo grass die. And it has.
Out on his ranch, Pike kneels to touch a sea of stubby, dry grass, burnt to about the shade of his straw cowboy hat.
You can see what we're up against. This old stuff is no good at all, and we're in a fire hazard.
Pike's cows won't eat this stuff, so he has to buy hay hauled in from greener pastures or corn. With fields of both withering from Indiana to Colorado, his feed prices have spiked. Pike can't make money feeding cattle this way, so he sold most of his herd to a slaughterhouse.
I've been in the business for 62 years. That's quite a little while. Certainly, this is the least cattle I've owned in at least 52 years.
And we heard similar stories last year in Texas and Oklahoma.
Dan Loy at Iowa State University says that now, with drought sparking a sell-off in Kansas and Nebraska...
Well, the national cattle herd currently is the lowest it's been since 1950.
When there were half as many people. The effects of this drought will take years to play out. Desperation selling is suppressing beef prices for now, but it's also butchering the production capability of this industry. Ranchers are sacrificing healthy cows that would otherwise keep having calves. So supply's bound to tighten next year, leaving customers paying more. And a lot of ranchers wishing they still had cattle to sell. I'm Frank Morris for Marketplace.
To China now, where officials have just arrested more than 2,000 people alleged to be involved in the country's vast counterfeit drug industry. As Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the impact will be felt well beyond China.
Police in China say they caught 24 crime organizations involved in making nearly $200 million worth of counterfeit drugs, from fake diabetes medication to rabies vaccines that contain nothing but salt water. Beijing Institute of Technology professor Hu Xingdou says this is all good news, but it's not enough to tackle what has become a very serious global problem.
China often has these types of campaigns, but you cannot stop this problem with a campaign. The root of the problem is that the pharmaceutical industry in China is very poorly regulated and extremely corrupt.
Hu says it's rare that fake drugs from China end up in the U.S., but they do end up in other developing countries in Southeast Asia and Africa, places where buying quality pharmaceuticals can be the difference between life and death. For its part, China's government has delivered harsh sentences in the past when it's found officials responsible for fake drugs. 5 years ago, the head of China's Food and Drug Watchdog Agency was executed for failing to supervise the market properly. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Now to the Cayman Islands. When I think of them, I think of beaches, island breezes, and of course, tax havens. Mm-hmm. The British territory has 91,000 registered companies, including 235 banks. But now, because of pressure to plug a budget hole, the government is proposing a 10% income tax on foreign workers. Anthony Travers is chairman of the Cayman Islands Stock Exchange, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how long have you been living and working in the Cayman Islands?
37 years, I'm happy to say.
That sounds pretty nice. And how have things changed since then, if at all?
Well, dramatically. I mean, you know, when I came here, there were no roads, no newspapers, no television, no radio. And now it's the fifth largest financial center in the world. So we believe in the tax-free structure here. You know, the Cayman Islands is probably the last bastion of free capitalism.
Okay, so as you understand it, who is this new tax going to hit?
If it were enacted, the proposal is that it only applies to foreign workers in the Cayman Islands.
These are just people that are working there, not somebody who has an account there or is running their business there. They actually have to be working there?
That's correct. It certainly doesn't apply to investors or any of the financial industry. It's people who are resident on the island who are not Caymanian, that is to say, the expatriate workers.
Okay, so what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't the government do that to try to fill a budget hole?
Well, I think the firestorm of negativity that's been caused here comes about because for 200 years, the Cayman Islands has never had any form of direct taxation on anyone resident in the island, so it is a major change.
But where do you think businesses or people are going to go if this tax goes into effect? I mean, there's not a place really that exists that is going to have a competitive tax situation, even if they put in this 10% tax, right?
I think the concern is that this is seen as a thin end of a wedge. The pressure on this is coming from the British government, not the Cayman Islands government. And I think what they want to see is higher taxes generally. And the feeling is that if tax is introduced here at all, any form of direct tax, then the rates will only go up.
Anthony Travers, chairman of the Cayman Islands Stock Exchange, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeff, Southwest Airlines, I don't know if you fly Southwest ever, but, you know, they do the seating on the first-come, first-served basis. You just get one of those things and go on the plane.
I know it all too well. I have a young child, so they cut me a little break, but after he's five, we're back in the back.
Good. Well, it wasn't quite good enough for one high school junior named Mac Breedlove, who was on his way to a lacrosse tournament.
Right.
And according to CBS News, he decided to skip the line so that he could get a better seat.
Hmm.
Well, his coaches were on board, and they coordinated with the airline crew, and they made him go to the front of the plane during the flight and get on the PA system and apologize to all of the passengers.
Oh, man.
He says he's learned a valuable life lesson. Just be patient.
Wow. Yeah, I guess you just got to wait your turn. But give some credit to those coaches, I guess, for spotting a life lesson in the moment. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.